lezione Sofia.
Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom, and welcome to our beloved Rabbi Mike Foyer. Shalom.
Oh, shalom, Yishai. Good to see you.
Great to see you again. I haven't seen you in too long.
I've missed you.
Yeah, my show suffered a lot, and, you know.
Sure that's not true.
Anyway, it's good to have you back on the show, and it's good to be here at Pardes Institute, a premier institute here in Yerushalayim in Talpiot. Really up-and-coming neighborhood here. Really a lot of fun.
It is true, and we have an up-and-coming building next door.
That's right. We're excited about your new building. And in general, lots of new buildings coming up in Yerushalayim. If you just turn off the news for 2 days and just look at the building, you'll be convinced that everything is honky-dory.
That redemption is at hand.
That's right, really. You just don't listen to the news. Don't go to Twitter. And just look out at the horizon. You'll see, especially in the summer, it's so beautiful right now here. We have an amazing Torah portion called Pinchas. And you and I have missed recording in the last two Torah portions, which set up a lot of this stuff, so we'll have to go back just a tad. Suffice it to say that if I go back to the Torah portion in the book of Numbers in Bamidbar, I go back to Chukat, all right? And in that Torah portion, three great heroes either pass away or are told that they're going to pass away. So we're talking about the death of Aaron, the death of Miriam, and the impending, ensuing, announced
departure of Moshe.
Right. Okay, so it's announced in that Torah portion. Why do I say this now? Because in this week's Torah portion, there are going to be crowned three new heroes, which I think specifically replace those three. Check this out. Joshua is going to replace Moshe Rabbeinu. Pinchas, a new priest, is going to replace, and from which many high priests are going to be issued, is going to replace Aaron.
Interesting.
And Benot Slavchad, the woman kind of heroes, replace the woman hero Miriam.
Okay? I didn't see that one coming.
Three heroes replace this missing generation, and this Torah portion, Pinchas, is really all about the new generation. It's all about the new generation. So the first hero that we're going to meet is Pinchas. Now, Pinchas, last week's Torah portion.
This time, last week.
That's right. And maybe for you in America, if you're listening outside of the land of Israel, it might
be. Oh, it's not until next week that we come back together?
You know what? I want to issue a protest against that. Really, I really think
it
that's
is so
wrong.
It's so unnecessary.
It's just not right.
And confusing.
And why keep us so apart for so long? And I heard from somebody who wrote me an email saying, no, the diaspora way is the more correct way to read, whatever it is. I'm like, who cares? Let's just figure this out and get back together. Sorry, that was not very, like, Jewishly.
Who cares?
Yeah, that's not. I did not phrase that in the proper yeshiva fashion. In any case, last week, we had the extremely challenging spiritual rebellion, which was really a giant political rebellion against Moses when Zimri takes Cosby and has public intercourse with her next to the tent of meeting.
Yes.
This was not, and it turns out it was not just a personal...
A licentious act.
A licentious act. It wasn't a bender or something like that, okay? It was a full-on political challenge and a religious challenge to the Mosaic, both the Mosaic leadership...
And the Mosaic law.
And the Mosaic law. And I'm thinking, like, was it another version of the golden calf? Some way it was not. In some way it was a very, you know, Moses was gone then. There wasn't a tent of meeting exactly then.
And also I think the reason that the golden calf is both so disastrous and yet such a transformative moment for Israel is that ultimately it was rooted in a real need. Right, that Moshe had been in the place of leadership and almost that sort of divine figurehead for the people from the rawness of slavery through the Red Sea, and so what they wanted was their leader back.
Right.
Here, they don't want to be told what to do.
Right,
that's a very different root cause.
Now, the director general of Hebron, Uri Karzin, told me that he had read in Jonathan Sachs that Jonathan Sachs said another damning part of the story. Is that,
I think it's damning if you say it. Damning, like Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sachs.
That's right. Is that this was really their first meeting with another nation up close? They're about to come into the land of Israel. They're about to take part in some kind of assimilationist
shared culture
moment.
Yeah.
And it's like, bang, you fell so hard at first.
It makes sense, actually. I never really thought about it in that terms, but because the sort of Sinit team, which was the location where it occurred, is look back to even within the Tanakh itself.
What was the word you used?
Shittim.
Shittim is
the location is where they were.
Yeah.
So looked back both within even within the Chumash, mm-hmm. you know, later in. When they go to war with Midian, and then later in Sefer Micha, when they refer back to the sin of Am Yisrael at Bilam, it's kind of looked back at as a fundamental failure, almost on that category of the golden
mm-hmm.
calf.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense then that it's representative of the failure of first contact.
So then Pinchas, I have a new take on Pinchas. I'm very excited about this. Oh, check this out. So Pinchas is two thoughts on this. So Pinchas goes and he kind of sneaks into this tent as they're doing this public exhibitionism, and he spears them through.
That's right.
Right in their privates.
Yes.
And which is, we don't have time to get back to last week's Torah portion, but just like Bilam knew exactly the exact point at which to kind of
curse the people when God's anger was present.
So he knew the exactitude. So did Pinchas, kind of had an exactitude on what this was really about. He spears them through their privates as they're
in flagrante delicto.
Thank you for...
It's a phrase that just doesn't... You don't get to use it so often.
Thank you for G-rating that. I can see parents listening to this podcast with their kids. Yeah, thank God he didn't say anything inappropriate. And that's the way we do it for you here, folks. We keep it appropriate.
If slightly amusing.
Right. So he strikes them. My first thought to you is that, Rabbi Mike, is that, okay, so everybody wants to discuss this kind of action, which is... what's the word I'm looking for?
Zealotry,
zealousness, radicalness.
Vigilante justice.
Right? And it's a big problem, and I'm sure at this institution, actions like that, and we have in the last few years in Israel, we can have many stories where people can have, and I'll throw out immediately three. One was the Baruch Goldstein massacre at the tomb of the fathers and mothers in Hebron. The murder of the Prime Minister Rabin.
Yep.
And two or three years ago, the stabbing at the gay pride parade in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Okay, so there are these moments
problematic moments,
vigilante moments, where I'm not getting into...
right, wrong.
I'm certain that those people that did those acts looked intellectually to Pinchas and said to themselves, there are moments in time...
Oh, yes.
Where I have to break through. And I'm not justifying or anything like that, but one could make arguments in different directions, including that maybe those people did
The important piece I hear you pointing out is that whatever one may personally feel about vigilantism, the Torah clearly puts it forward here as a model of justice.
Right, but yet the Talmud says that had Zimri killed Pinchas,
he would have been innocent.
He would have been totally in the right.
Yes.
So that's an amazing thing. Like,
well, and as the Torah itself points out, that the Brit Shalom, as we speak about almost every year, this sort of covenant of peace, which is a very strange thing for Pinchas to receive in return for even a zealous righteous act, but involved the murder of two people, one of whom was a prince in Israel, right? That Brit Shalom he receives is a broken covenant, because the Vav in Shalom is the only Vav in the entire Torah which is written broken in half.
Right.
And so, like, I think there's a recognition, even in the text of the Torah itself, that... I mean, it's clear he gets a blessing. God elevates him.
Not just a blessing, he also gets a public approbation from God.
And an eternal covenant.
For the doubters.
Yes.
Right.
An eternal covenant for Kahuna. And the Kohanim are ultimately meant to be the peacemakers. Nevertheless, I think everyone recognizes it would have been better if it hadn't have had to happen this way. There's something very broken in the nature of both the sin and the context and even the action. And I think that that's classic Torah learning.
Wasn't Brit Shalom one of the names of the kind of Jewish, left?
It's funny you say that. I've thought about that before. Brit Shalom, just a drop of history, was the organization founded by early 20th century European intellectuals like Martin Buber and Judah Magnus and Arthur Rupin, who had a vision of a multinational state or a confederation, Jewish Arab confederation here. And yes, they were, some of them were actually pacifists.
Right.
Others had a more pacifistic worldview, but like Buber said, like, you know, we're not actually pacifists because if you come to kill me, I'm gonna kill you first.
But bottom line is that how ironic it is.
Yeah, I've never really gotten into it, but it has occurred to me that it's quite strange. I mean, likely, and they were all, by the way, scholars, so it's impossible that they chose that name and they didn't contemplate the nature of it.
Right.
So I don't know. Actually, I don't
I'll give you another example of that. The pride flag, the rainbow flag, that is a great irony. It's one of the great ironies of history.
Yes.
They're using it as saying, look, you know, people, there's so many
different types
and kinds, and sure, they all melt together in a beautiful spectrum. But the other side is like the rainbow is supposed to represent exactly the opposite of this kind of behavior. Well,
in the Bible sense, yeah. It's God saying, let me just remind you what happened last time you all started to mix species.
Right.
I mean, it's literally
in my stand-up side.
Which I missed.
Yes, in my stand-up side, I say the reason that they have that flag, the rainbow flag, is they go, oh, don't hit me. Don't strike me, God. You see, you promised. You promised you wouldn't strike us again, okay? But anyway, that's a discussion
for another time.
Yes, and of course, folks, this is just all in good humor, and we are respectful and loving of all peoples and that are. I'm just trying to say there's a peace here, there's a love here, and we're not here passing judgment in a harsh way, and certainly not calling for any kind of vigilante justice.
No, okay? God forbid.
No,
but at the same time, we have to let these questions come up if the Torah poses them.
That's right. And here's where I want to get exactly to the second point, which is there is a Maisa Pinchas that you have to do all the time in this world. And that is, in a world of intellectual bullying, a world where you cannot say, today in Israel, you cannot say two things. You cannot say, I'm not with the general gay agenda. I'm not talking about individuals.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say, well, you know, we should consider, my wife tweeted very, very strongly. She said, if people are allowed to cut off their breasts, take all kinds of medicine and hormones to change their
gender.
To make
themselves feel normal.
Right? Then if somebody feels gay and wants to attempt the same way to go into heterosexuality, why isn't that normal? Well, the forces that be out there will intellectually bully you to death.
Yes.
To like not even, I'm not talking about doing things. I'm talking about saying things. Okay?
No, I've been watching what's going on in the media.
So my point is, sometimes a Maisa Pinchas is not to run anybody through with a blade. But what it is to say, hey, I'm not going to be bullied by you. Here's what I believe.
It's to cut against the grain.
Right.
And here's the thing is that really a Maisa Pinchas, let's go with Pshat in the Torah, is a Maisa Shel Kana'ut. Right? And Kana'ut is a very difficult word. It can
zealousness.
Zealousness, but it's also jealousy.
Right. Well, aren't those words actually related in the English language?
And I would argue that the difference between them is precisely why Pinchas was a righteous person and not a murderer.
Right.
Right, because you know the Midrash says that that Pinchas went to Moshe and all the leaders who were weeping the tent and said, "What are we supposed to do, Moshe? You taught us the lacha," and then Moshe said back to him, "Like the one who receives the letter should fulfill its contents." Meaning, and that's the definition of a
just kanai. Break it down for a second, like Moses.
He says, if you know what to do, then you need to do it.
That's right.
You can't ask me what you should do, because the problem with that is that as soon as you're not completely consumed by the righteousness of God's will, and you enter in your own calculus, even to the extent of asking someone else for their approval that this is the right thing to do, you move out of zealotry into jealousy. That the personal element of, like, somehow it bothers me. And that's the thing, is that this did not bother Pinchas.
Right.
It bothered Pinchas on the behalf of God.
Right.
And that's what God says explicitly.
Right. He says, and let's be clear now, the godly retribution was going to be against the nation.
Yes.
The nation was going to be struck down from this.
Yeah.
There was a moment where basically it was already happening. Right. But Pinchas, I just want to get to the point that Pinchas is a type of Mashiach. He saves the people.
Right.
He saves the nation. And through this through this tough moment of striking down.
And the problem is that I could deceive myself into believing that I am completely acting on the behalf of God.
Right.
Right. And yet the reality is that level of self-knowledge is very rare. And really it's why Pinchas became the great leader that he did and wasn't condemned for his act.
Even our Talmud, even our rabbis, everybody knows this is a very tough question and issue. Certainly in our time where Jews have strength again to do these kind of acts.
Oh, yeah.
And I really want to tell you that I appreciate that we were able to delve into this thing and not shy away from it. And I think that's really what the Torah is saying. But basically, we have to meet it. If Zimri and Cosby went to exhibitionism, and then the next countermeasure to that was their public execution, then where we have to meet it is at least be willing to discuss it.
Yeah, this is a public issue. It needs to be discussed in a public forum.
Right, and not suppressed.
Yeah.
Because it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It would be remiss of me not to mention that according to the Zohar and according to many Midrashim, this very Pinchas is going to yet again later on in history behave zealously, and it's going to be in the form of Elijah. And he, Pinchas, lives a very long life, somehow becomes Elijah, however you want to understand that. And then Elijah is never, he does not die, but is taken up to heaven in a fiery chariot.
Let him come back soon.
Right. And God says, you're so zealous for me. Maybe a little too zealous. I'm going to bring you back to the earth to show you that indeed there is redemption. It will work out. Not forever will my name be sullied, but rather in the end of times, you will be the heralder, Hamevaser, to the coming of Mashiach.
Yeah, and the sort of flaw in Elijah's zealousness, however we want to call it.
Zealitude.
His latitude. Yeah. You can identify there is he lacked full faith in the people.
Right.
And he says to God that they've nullified your covenant. And God says, whoa, that they haven't done. And so there is a certain element of that if you believe redemption is possible, you have to believe that Am Yisrael is capable of bringing it.
Mm.
So Reb Shlomo used to say that all the time. Mm-hmm. To believe in Mashiach is to believe in Am Yisrael.
Right.
Because if you believe in Am Yisrael that we can bring Mashiach, then you believe in Mashiach. If you don't believe in Am Yisrael, you don't believe in Mashiach.
Right. And that's also Rabbi Nachman's great phrase, which is, if you believe that things can be ruined, believe that they can be fixed. It's just that simple. Oh, and I forgot one more little part that I can't skip. So we all know TED Talks.
Oh, if you knew TED like I know TED.
Yeah, I knew TED, and you sure are no TED. No, I know. I listen to TED, but sometimes it's really fabulous stuff, really fabulous stuff. And TED has got another offshoot of an NPR. They have from time to time a compilation of various TED Talks on a theme.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very well done. And there's a guy there who's, I think, obviously Jewish. His name is Guy Raz. He hosts the show. It's a very well done show. Mm-hmm. Very well, great, NPR style, cut audio, fabulous. You know, I sometimes, I'm jealous of the level of
the production. The resource they're able to bring to the production
process. They just do it right. They just do it with sounds that also go in stereo from left to right ear, ding, ding. It's like, it's well done. Any case, they had a recent show about the seven deadly sins, sins. I don't remember.
It was Dopey, Sneezy, Doc.
It's funny you say that. They related to actually the characters of Gilligan's Island.
Oh yeah,
and like she represents Ginger represents lust, and this guy represents pride and whatever it is.
Who's Gluttony?
Gluttony is I think it's the captain. I don't remember. Well, one of them is Glutton. They figured out a way to say about everybody. In any case. The show itself was very good. There was one very moving part where the mayor of Kansas City talked about the fact that he saw in a newspaper that his city was an obese city, one of America's obesest cities, and he realized that he himself was obese and went on a citywide diet, created new parks, created a website that everybody loses calories, that everybody loses weight, we will, as a city, lose a million pounds. and I was so moved by that. That, to me, is the great Americana.
That's awesome.
It was like, here's a guy who's like had this, like, from Kansas
Awakening,
City.
Right.
Oh, and he said this was the number one city in America for fast food chains. And he just, reversed it, and it became one of America's healthiest cities. And it was just a beautiful story. Anyway, I was just very moved by that. And I love hearing stuff that inspires. And, great countries like America can inspire you about leadership and things like that. Great stuff. But the first one which they had, which was Lust out of the seven, all six were very interesting, but the first one was absurd. They had somebody on who had written a book called Sex at Dawn, and was basically saying the following. Biologically speaking, we are not a monogamous race. And it was a whole book about finding about non-monogamy as the healthy natural choice for this. That although the guy admits that his parents has been married for 57 years
and they seem happy,
right? They seem happy, and he can't name me like I would
and
have
he's
asked
lonely.
Him. Well, he's got a partner, you know. We'll see what I'd like to forget him. Forget him. Maybe it works for you. Whatever. Show me a society where that works. You know what I mean? Show me. I want it to be like, hello, I'm raising my hand. Just one question. Can you point to a society where that works?
He can't.
Okay. But they put that up on NPR as the option, and that was it. That was it. The lust part of the story was no lust is a good thing, and it's the healthy and the right wing, and basically reversed the whole consciousness there. And I was like, and I'm learning, I'm preparing for our show on Parshat Pinchas, and I'm thinking to myself, Bemet, really, is this your option, NPR? For it's almost like what did I see? And I'm finishing off with this. It was a Zimri Cosby moment where they put it up as.
Yes.
Here's the alternative life.
Yes, and I think it goes to the heart of so much of the struggle which is happening between, and it's part of the miscommunication, I think, between the sort of the straight world and the gay world, so to speak, because the straight world still perceives the gay world as a licentious world. And one of the mistakes, as we've spoken about before, one of the mistakes of the way in which the Pride Parade has developed and shows itself is it doesn't come across necessarily as a pride parade. It comes across, like you said last time we talked about, as a sex parade, right? Again, without getting into what it actually is for people. And so the challenge, this is the middle ground. I've had this discussion with my students before, is there a place for something called sexual discipline? For whomever one chooses to exercise that sexual desire with, not even getting into that, right? But is there a place to say, yes, okay, I have these feelings, I have these desires. Perhaps actually the healthy right thing to do is to give them a right place and to deny them other places. That's something our society is kind of unwilling to do right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of the don't tell me what to do.
Right.
And it's corrosive. I agree with you. It is corrosive to social
power. I was shocked that was what they put up. Forget the guy that wrote the book. I get that. But that NPR would put that as the option to deal with the seven deadly sins, and that's the one. The rest were all very normal and good.
I think it's because within our society, there's no way to frame that as a negative. They have no way to frame sexual desire as a negative.
Well, they could have put up, I don't know. Anyway, they could have put up some family values.
Exactly. That's what I meant. In the NPR world, you put up family values, and you're going to lose all your funders.
All right. You can have fun. And funders with family values. And sometimes
we put the fun in funding, by the way, folks. If you want to send us money, we're happy to use
that's
it.
That's right. We put the fun. That's right. And I had Governor Mike Huckabee, and I sold in Chevron.
I sold
him on Ma'at Machpelah, being also a paradigm of family values.
Sure.
I was like, that's cool. All right. Speaking of family values, the next part of this Torah portion, Pinchas, is all about the census. And a census is taken, and the families are listed. And it may seem a little kind of, it may seem extraneous, but on the other
and
hand...
And even repetitive. This is not the first time in this book that we've seen it.
Right, but this is a new census.
It's new generation.
Yeah, new generation, and we'll also see a lot of very radical changes. For example, the tribe of Shimon is...
Get decimated. More
well,
than...
Not, well, they're cut down by like 50%, something like that.
Oh, which is more than decimated. Decimated is to take a tenth out.
I thought it was to make it into a tenth.
No. Decimation is literally to take
one
tenth,
one tenth,
which is why Menachem Begin used to say that our people weren't just decimated; we were tertiary.
Right, tertiary. That's right. Okay, so there's. But on the other hand, if you love the Jewish people, reading these names and understanding that we're talking about very real families, there's something very I don't know. I'm lacking the word here.
Energizing.
Yeah, pleasant. There's something like I'm like, wow, look, there's really a mishpacha, like the Dan family. Had the Shuham family within the Dan. These are the sub-tribes. These are the big families in the tribes. Or Yachtze'eli, the Yachtze'el family. It's also good
if you think about having kids. It's a great place to look for names.
Right, that's right, that's right. That's right. If you're biblically inclined, these are great places for names for sure. And they count the Levites as well. And basically, it's a very important moment that we're understanding that there's a transition. The past generation is gone. These are the people that are going to inherit the land.
Yeah, that's a critical piece there, because they're not just the people that are going to inherit the land. The motion is over. We're at the fords of the Jordan River right now.
Right.
I mean, this is...
On the Jordan Jericho.
Yes, meaning the first census of the book took place right before we got underway. And we discussed several times how it broke down quickly. This is the census which is taking place and saying, okay, who made it? Like, now the journey to get there is over. Mm-hmm. The next stage of actually arriving.
Right.
And so we need to make a new census, say, like, well, who are we now?
It's reminiscent also of Ezra, where you have in the book of Ezra suddenly a list of the families that came to the land of Israel. Like, yeah. These are the ones that came out. And you get a name.
Yeah.
Just the idea that you get a name in the Bible because you left Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
And you're here in the land of Israel. That's like, and you're one of the people that made it here. And you get your name, like, on black and parchment. That's amazing.
It's a fantastic thing.
And so here, though, we have and nobody is left from that generation except for Caleb ben Yefunneh and Yoshua ben Nun. The Torah tells us this. And then comes an amazing chapter in the Torah, a redemptive chapter, and that is the story, and this is chapter 27, and that is the story of the daughters of Tzlavchad. The daughters of Tzlavchad, son of Hefer, son of Gilad, son of Mechir, son of Menashe, of the families Menashe, son of Joseph. And Rashi tells us the reason Joseph is named here, we know Menashe is the son of Joseph, it's because he loved the land. And so too, they're going to love the land. And they have names. Their name is Machla, Noah, Chogla, Milka, and Tirzah. They stood before Moses, before Eleazar the Kohen, and before the leaders of the entire assembly at the entrance of the Tent of Meeting, saying, quote, "Our father died in the wilderness, but he was not amongst the assembly that was gathering against Hashem in the assembly of Korach, but he died of his own sin, and he had no sons. He was not a rebel. He didn't rebel against Moses." He and this leads to a big discussion. What was exactly his sin?
Who was he? Right.
Who was he? But in any case, their message is, he's not one of the people who don't deserve a portion of the land. He's not one of the people who rejected the land, and he didn't reject Moses. He had his own sin. Maybe it was
the Mekoshes Eitzim.
Right. Maybe he was gathering the sticks on Shabbos.
Right.
Or what was? Or maybe he was
one of those people that was the Mapilim.
Right. Maybe he was one of the folks that wanted to go into the land of Israel against the will of God at that point.
After the sin of the spies.
After the sin of the spies. But okay. But at least he was a Zionist, you know? Okay. So. Why should the name of our father be omitted? Be omitted from among his family because he had no son. Give us, the girls, a possession amongst our father's brothers. And Moses brought their claim before Hashem. Hashem said to Moses, saying, "The daughters of Tzlavchad are speaking properly. You shall surely give them a possession of inheritance amongst the brothers of their father, and you shall cause the inheritance of their father to pass over to them." So we learn from here a lot about legal estate planning,
the nature of inheritance.
But it's also these women who stand up kind of and properly demand more.
Yes. It's also, I think, a powerful expression of a principle, which Rashi points out as well, that if this was the law, then Moshe should have taught it without their prompting, right? But there's a general principle, is megalgin zchut al yedei zakaim, right? That God brings goodness into the world at the hands of those who merit.
Right.
So their desire, notice it doesn't say give us a portion in the land. It says, why should our father be forgotten? Like, right. Here we are. We just did this big census. Imagine how it felt when all the family's houses, so not only just lined up, but had their names written down. And they saw, wow, our father's name is gone.
Right.
It's gone forever. Like, that can't be. And so they...
Not only that, but here we are. We are...
And he's not gone, right? We still exist. And so it's, I think, a beautiful expression of the fact that God also responds to the will of humanity. And in particular, like you said, when their desire is for more, how do we serve you more? How do we do it better?
Right.
Right? What help us to do the right thing? Is that, that is a tremendous power for drawing the divine will into the world.
Mm-hmm. I know this is going to be a strange thing, and my mind was considering whether to say it or not. And
is there a light going off on the dashboard, or is it just blinking yellow light?
Yeah, I'm not sure, but there's a verb here, which is that they stood before. There's actually just the only place where there's a similar verb to that they stood before him is actually in terms of bestiality, when a woman is not supposed to stand in front of an animal for bestiality. Okay, mm-hmm. The only reason I say that is because it's like they stood with the ultimate properness, where the other one is like this ultimate, like, what are we talking about here, you know? But it's real. And it happens, you know. And there's, you know, Catherine the Great. There's all kinds of stuff like that there. But like here. It's like they stood in front of the court with humility, yet with demanding that balance of honoring the male patriarchy and the law and the God, and then at the same time being like, I'm a Jewish woman and I'm here to stand before you And I'm not using my wiles and my beauty, and I'm sure they were all, you know, amazing women.
No, you notice the context. We just saw that type of rebellion.
Right. And I'm standing here, and I'm demanding something, but I'm doing it with the right style of request, with the right love of honor, with that balance, right? But with the tremendous challenge of Judaism is, where do you honor the rabbis, the system, the God, and where do you argue with him? And that's an Abrahamic quality,
right?
Where he knows the right balance, where he understands the right balance. I think if you ever speak to a Jew, you realize.
Every once in a while, I do.
When you speak to like an Orthodox Jew, you see that we're always about, for example, a book that is on its you hang out with non-Jews and you see a Bible book, a Torah book that's upside down, and you flip it,
and you're like, what's up with that?
Right, we gotta, and they're like, yeah, what are you doing? Like, no, the book has to be honored, yeah. And also I can't put a sitter on top of a chumash, right? I can't put a prayer book on top of a
Bible.
Because there's an honor level. Hierarchy. There's a hierarchy.
I tell you, where this has come out in, I've seen it, that I have colleagues here at Pardes, women, Orthodox women, who have become rabbis in the last couple of years, something which is really sort of edgy within the Orthodox world. I don't want to go into the edginess in the Orthodox world. What's been interesting to me is that many of their students, who progressive Jews, have said to them, like, I don't understand. Like, what's the big deal? Just do what you want. Be a rabbi. And don't appreciate the level of struggle of these women who are deeply committed to Torah and mitzvah, tremendous scholars.
Right.
Like, no, like, that's not how it works.
Right.
Like, we've been trying to find a way to actually legitimately do this from within, and it's been a tremendous struggle, and I know they live in real tension, and it really expresses in many ways that sense of a standing with kavod, with honor, like you said.
Mm-hmm. It's a tremendous balance in Judaism. It's a tremendous balance. And we are, as a nature of a people, we're actually like, there's an element of tremendous awe and respect, and then there's an element of, like, we don't.
Dirty mud-slinging fistfights.
Right, no, but we are not people of systems, and you're
and
not going
to... submission.
Submission. You're not going to get us into your big system of idolatry, and everybody's going to be, yes, yes, yes. Like, Abraham is going to break those
idols. It just
doesn't
work that way, yeah.
Right, so there's a tension right there.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, there's a tension for the Jewish people. In any
it's
case...
kind of like herding cats.
Okay, not going to go there. Here we go. So then Moses said to God... I want to make it clear to you that you're dying. And so we're going to finish off this book where we're getting close to the end of the book. He's going to tell him to go up to the mountain of Avarim. Many ways to understand that. A mountain of passes to see the passage into La'avor, into the land of Israel, or reminding us of Ivri, how he was on one side and the rest of the world was on the other side. So you're going to be on one side, the Jewish people are going to be on the other side.
The mountain of transitions.
Transitions, okay. And then I want you to see the land, which I've given to the children of Israel, and you're going to be gathered to your nation, just like your brother Aaron did. And why? Because you rebelled against my word in the wilderness of Tzin in the assembly strife to sanctify me at the waters before their eyes. They were the waters of strife at Kadesh in the wilderness of Tzin. Okay, so we talked about it last week, but really, I'm one of the people, I subscribe to the idea that really it was a generational thing. Like, you belong to the other generation, you treated the next generation like you treated the last generation, you're really part of that time. And then there's one of the most shocking, and Rabbi Eric Levy that I listened to pointed out how shocking this verse is, one of the most shocking verses in the Torah, which is like, I'm going to die. Before I die, we're going to reverse roles for a second. And it says, Vaydaber Moshe l'Hashem l'amor. Moses spoke to God saying, that's the same language as God spoke to Moses saying, and Moses is like, I'm your humble servant. Here it's like, all right, you want to... I'm out. Before I'm out, I got to tell you this, and this is what you got to do.
I had a great moment on this week. I have the custom of reading what's called Shnei Mikra Echad Targum, right? You read the Hebrew text of the Torah twice in the Aramaic translation. Once you go Hebrew, Aramaic, Hebrew. And I do an aliyah every day of the week. There's 7 aliyot, 7 days. Anyway, so I got to this line. In Hebrew, I subconsciously read it as Vayaber Hashem El Moshe Lemor.
Right.
And then I looked at the Aramaic, and I was like, wait. That's wrong.
Right.
And I looked back to the Hebrew. I was like, oh no, I actually didn't read the words, because it is such a radical change in perspective to have Moshe sort of like flowing back upstream, as it were.
Right. I mean, this is not correct, but if you could for a second think of it this way, it's almost like Moses is kind of like commanding God.
Well, and elsewhere the sages point out that the Lashon of Dibul is a lashon of command and harshness. It's right. like Moshe was making a demand here. If he wasn't commanding, he was certainly demanding.
Right. But it's so funny because it's like it's not from a position of strength exactly, right?
No, he's over. He's done.
Yeah,
you're God done. Just made it very clear. You're done.
But maybe we don't understand some stuff here. You know, maybe there's stuff that's beyond our understanding of what Moses was, his level of. Anyway,
I would point out there is a certain element of strength in this. Why? Because now Moshe can honestly say, I have no dog in this fight, so to speak. Like, this is not about me. Mm. You've just made it clear to me that my age is over. Mm. So now I'll make it clear to you that it was never about me. Mm-hmm. Not that God thought it was, but right. like, and I want to make sure that the people make it.
Right. That's very interesting. And so he says an amazing phrase, which we heard a little bit, a similar phrase earlier. May Hashem, God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the assembly who shall go out before them and who shall come in before them. That usually means war. Be able to fight war.
Yep.
Who shall take them out and who shall bring them in, and not let the assembly of Hashem be like sheep that have no shepherd.
Bad.
Right. What is in the Ten Commandments? What does Moses say in the movie? What does Moses say when he gets to the well in Midian? He's like, "Never has a lost sheep had so many shepherds." Right? when all the daughters of
oh, really?
Yeah,
that's a corny line. I mean, it's like biblical bad humor.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, I think this is very important. You pointed out that the last place we saw this Shem, this divine name, was in the rebellion with Korach.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That when Moshe calls upon God to take retribution on Korach, he calls upon this name, Hashem Elokei Haruchot L'Kol Basar.
Right?
And here he does it again.
God of the spirit of all flesh.
And here he does it again. And then we double down on the concept, because when God says back to Moshe, Kachachat Yehoshua ben Nun, right? You can take... For the leader, Yehoshua ben Nun.
So take Joshua.
Right. Asher ish asher ruach bo.
Right.
Right. He's someone, he's a man in whom there is spirit. And Rashi mm-hmm. brings the Midrash and says, what is this whole talk of spirit? It's that there's a quality of leadership, which is the ability to speak to each person as who they are. Right. And to bear them for who they are. If you look in Rashi, the language of savlanut comes through. And it's a very important difference in the model of leadership between Moshe and Korach. And I think it's why Moshe was so concerned in this moment, because Korach also was able to actually speak to each person as who they were. Mm-hmm. That was why he was successful in his rebellion. He went to each person, figure out what bothers you. Oh, I can find your sore spot. But what did he do? He used it to subsume that person into him. Right, that's why it was the rebellion of Korach, and he managed to gather all these disgruntled people. And you see this model of sort of like populist leadership, which is that really, I'm not interested in you and your problems, except insofar as that the energy that you lend me will let me get the power I want. But I can speak to you as if I care about you, right, to each individual, and use that to serve my purposes. Whereas the model of leadership that Yehoshua represents and Moshe represented is, no, I actually care about you as you. And therefore, in order to do my job, because my goal is to actually serve all of you as an individual, I have to be able to relate to you as you, and this person, that person is that person. I don't want to just lump you all together into some unit that serves my needs. Mm-hmm. It's such a powerful image of leadership. At the same time, of course, you noted that the context here is the ability to bring them out to war. And in war, you don't want everybody on their own recognizance. Right? You don't want this sort of the private or the sergeant, you know, et cetera, just deciding, you know what? We're going to do it my way today. This is what I want.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the difference? Isn't that the same thing? No, the answer is that I'm still going to go to war on behalf of God. Right? So the Ish Asher Ruach Bo has two ruchot. He has the ability to speak to the spirit of every individual, but he's also got that divine spirit which came to rest on Moshe, which he then shared, like, with the elders. And he's obviously, you know, the reason Yehoshua is chosen here is he's reaping the reward of his consistent service of Moshe and his service of Torah. He's the one who never left the tent. So I think it's just an incredibly powerful model of leadership here in both of those scales.
And there could have been other people that were chosen.
Midrash says that Moshe actually was out for himself in this moment.
He
wanted his sons, who get nothing.
Right.
And not only get nothing, in the Midrash, it doesn't play out well for Moshe's sons. They're like classic rabbi sons.
Right. And there's other great leaders around, including Kalev Ben Yefuneh.
Sure. Pinchas would have been the natural choice at this point of the story.
Right. But Pinchas has a different role. He's mm-hmm. going to be the son of Eleazar, and he's going to be the continuation of the priestly tribe.
And particularly the
priest of war.
Mashuach Milchama. Yeah, right. He's the priest of war.
You know, on Shabbos day, when we call up the first Aliyah, it's Kohen. So we go Kohen Krav, Yamod. So I always tell the Gabbai, I say, Kohen Krav. It's a time. It's a coin of war.
Great. Now every time I'm mincha and Shabbos afternoon, I'm not going to be able to not think
coin
of that.
Krav. Coin krav. It's a type
we
of.
We got a couple of big mean kohanim in my shul. I'm going to start calling them.
Yeah, coin krav. That's what it is. A
got like
krav
a 6 foot
battle.
Four group of kohanim in my shul. I don't know why.
Okay,
it's like so, big priests.
That's how I think about that coin krav. And so he's going to be. That's right. Pinchas is going to be the battling. I mean, it's like. And this is, goes to another principle in Judaism, a common principle, an important principle, which is if you've got you got to serve God with both sides of your heart, with your good side and your bad side.
Sure.
I remember, I think we talked about this maybe 2 years ago. I remember I said to you that I listened to a podcast and they said people who can it was like a success type of podcast and they were like people who can overcome their bad inclinations and their bad sides they'll be successful. People who can harness their bad inclinations will be mega successful.
Right.
Right?
Sure.
And so here's Pinchas. He's obviously a zealous type. Well, we're going to fit you to be the priest of war. It makes sense.
Right.
And all of us should take heed in that. Know how to serve God through your bad side, okay?
This is the Baal Shem Tov's famous formula for all self-improvement. I'll give it to you in three words.
Go.
Right? It's hachna'ah, havdalah, v'hamtaka. Right, first one has gains the ability to suppress. You're not an animal. You get some urge or some desire or some thought. You need to have the ability to say no.
Right.
Right. The next phase is havdalah, which is you're able to separate your selfhood from that desire. Meaning, oh, I'm me, and I see that this is coming up for me. It's a deeper mm-hmm. level than just suppressing because you can actually hold it and experience it, but not sort of let it consume you. And that's what allows for the hamtaka, the sweetening of it, which is the question is, okay, what deep essential self is this expressing?
Well, so are the three again?
Hachna'a, which is the sort of overcoming of that
in
urge.
In English, we call that suppression.
Subduing.
Subduing.
Right? Havdalah, which is separating from it, that you have a selfhood, which is not just my desire.
Mm-hmm.
And then hamtaka, which is the recognition that you don't have such powerful urges if they don't bespeak some essential side of yourself. Mm-hmm. They may be coming out in a way which is what we call mikulkal in sort of a warped fashion, but they are who you are. And so therefore, like you're saying, if you can find the way to sweeten it and to orient that very powerful side of yourself toward tikkun, toward some good, like you said, it's like a supercharge.
Can I call the show Suppress for Success? Is that a good one, or is that?
Yeah, I mean, maybe, although subdue to renew, I don't know. We'll talk about it later. You can call the show whenever you want.
Yeah, well, I always got to figure it out, and I don't have a lot of time today. So back to the original thing, we just saw that Joshua is going to get the Moses position, Pinchas is going to get the Aaron position, or I think it's really fair to say that it's Eleazar and Pinchas, meaning to say it's like a lineage.
Yeah, yeah. I was wondering where Eleazar fit in that
well,
for you.
Because the Kohen side of it is a lineage side.
And we do see, by the way, that the role of the priest will shift in the coming into the land, meaning there was no need for a priest of war in the wilderness.
Right.
That's an institution which is related to the conquest, which mm-hmm. is to come. So there's a necessary division.
Mm-hmm. And we, by the way, saw a modern priest of war, and that was Rabbi Gorin. Rabbi Gorin was a kind of semi-angelic, semi-priest of war person.
Oh, yes.
My mom relates that during the Yom Kippur War, he stood at the Bnot, that bridge.
Bnot Yaakov.
The Bnot Yaakov bridge, and standing there and saying, like, I will see you in Damascus. And he was just waving the tanks on, and people were just heartened by that because it was a tough war.
Yeah.
The situation was bad, and here he was
standing
there.
The original battle of Bnot Yaakov was when the fear was, as they said at the time, that the Third Temple was going to fall.
That's right.
Actually, the state would be destroyed.
That's right. So there he was, kind of giving people strength.
It's unfortunate they stopped 30 kilometers short of Damascus.
That's right. And the Lubavitch Rebbe, by the way, called for the flattening of Damascus at that time. I found that in the text. I found that. He actually said flatten Damascus. That's what he said.
Well, and I want to be clear why I said it, which is that I think the model is the difference between Germany after World War I and Germany after World War II.
Right.
If you don't feel the consequences of your choice to be the aggressor,
right,
then you don't have a reason not to be.
Mm-hmm.
And look where Syria is now.
Right. Bad shape, Syria. And then I think it's an important thing that Miriam, this lover of the people, this great prophetess, is kind of supplanted by these great women, these five great women, who also kind of sweeten the whole story here. That's maybe mm-hmm. the sweetest part of this whole story. It's that these incredible women want the land of Israel, and we're gonna meet them again.
Yes,
they're gonna come down the line. Anyway, the Torah portion finishes off with a long. array of it goes into legal
divine
mode.
Barbecue.
Right, divine barbecue, and it goes into legal mode, which is really about the korbanot. The end of the parsha gives us laws about korbanot. We are taught the laws of the korban tamid, the daily sacrifice, and of the musaf offerings. Okay. And I'm just going to touch on it for a second. Every morning, the Kohanim must offer a lamb on the Mizbeach after being slaughtered. The lamb is completely burnt as an Olah offering. That's what Olah means, which, by the way, means the Latin way of saying it is Holocaust, totally burnt. Oh, my gosh. What do you think about that? Just parenthetically, what do you think about that usage of about the second Holocaust in the
Rob
American
Peretz's comment?
Yeah,
American. You should know that that's hardly new.
Right. They have an article about it.
It's hardly new. I mean, right. That's been a discussion probably since the 80s. I don't know when the earliest reference was, but the silent Holocaust of intermarriage.
Right.
Listen, we can have a whole discussion about whether there's a wisdom in using that language.
Right, exactly.
But frankly, anybody who has a care for the continuity of the Jewish people, and particularly the Jewish people in America, needs to ask the question, like, wow, you know, Emil Fackenheim, very powerful thinker, reform rabbi of the post-Holocaust era, actually coined a phrase he called the 614th commandment, which is a worthwhile essay. People can Google it. It's very short, worthwhile to read. But the essence is that it's forbidden to give posthumous victories to Hitler. And part of that was you can't give up on God and you can't give up on being a Jew.
That sounds like an interesting essay.
Oh, it's a fascinating, fantastic essay. And sadly, I think that a lot of intermarriage, without judgment, right? You don't have to judge people to make these statements. And that's where the place where you can't have this conversation comes from.
Right.
It's like, I'm not allowed to express my opinion because you see it as judgment. What I'm pointing out to you is that if you choose to marry a non-Jew and live in a house with a Christmas bush and a Hanukkah tree and whatever, you're basically choosing to step away from the continuity of Jewish tradition. That's your choice, fine. Mm. But recognize that you're, in some way, I hate to say it to you, handing a victory to all the people throughout history who wanted to eliminate the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
If you just own that.
Right.
You're saying, no, but I'm making my personal choice. Okay, fine.
That's a very powerful thing you're saying. Very powerful.
Enochinami, you want to do what you're going to do, and I'm willing, as a human being, to honor your right to do that. But own the context that there have been throughout our history, Hitler chief amongst them, many people who have decided the world would be better off without the Jews. And you are basically handing them a posthumous victory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not necessarily a good enough reason to be a Jew, and that's part of the problem in American education. But you should at least accept that when he says something like a second Holocaust, oh, you can't speak like that. Ugh, he may have been lacking tact. We are Israeli, right, after all. But it doesn't make it any less true.
Yeah. And now he's walked some of these statements back.
That's because, as you said, there's a cultural intellectual bullying.
Right.
Furthermore, he's a politician and therefore has a more immediate aim, which is to get elected.
Right. But I think he could have calmly said, look, I may have used that the right term.
Well, I think
it comes from a concern for Jewish continuity.
Yeah.
All.
Yeah. And I think also you'll notice that he was caught because he did energize his base through both of his comments this week, meaning he got a lot of flack in the media and he might have gotten removed potentially as education minister. But there were quite a few people who vote for him anyway who are thinking, oh, yes, at least someone's willing to say this.
That's
out
right.
loud. Similar to Donald Trump, right, which is one of his great powers in rallying his base, is that he'll say things that have been irking people for a long time.
Right.
And unfortunately, it just goes to show you that I don't have a deep respect for, let's say, Donald Trump's ability to communicate, right? But it just goes to show you that if intelligent people will not articulate positions in the face of this sort of intellectual stifling atmosphere, then right. You know who's going to do it? People who aren't so intelligent and whose aims are not so high.
That's I will phrase it just a tad differently. People who are not going to succumb to intellectual bullying.
No, my point is that the people who can bespeak the depth and importance of these thoughts need to do it, because otherwise the people who do it won't necessarily be doing it for the best reasons.
But if you fit in and you're one of the in crowd, you're very likely to just toe the line. And I see, by the way, just on the retweeting level, if I say something that is just not very popular right now, I just see people. I can feel people
out
there are like, they flinch. They're like, look, if I even like this thing, if I even hit a like, which, by the way, does not mean that you like, right? I may be tainted by this phrase, and I don't know if I. And almost like they're taking a kind of imaginary poll. Can they?
I can relate to that. I mean, as someone who's trying to tell a story to left, right, religious, secular, Jew, Christian, there's a balance that you need to strike. And,
absolutely.
And one of the problems of social media is it lends itself to feeding frenzies.
Yes.
It doesn't lend itself to nuance and thought and discourse.
Right.
And so that's why I largely just am a what's called lurker.
Yeah. Is that a term? I didn't know about that.
Lurker. A lurker. I'm out there. I'm reading. You should just know, people, I'm out there. Right? But I'm not so responsive. Exactly. Working the shadows.
That's interesting. It's again, back to B'notz Lefchad. It's a balance. It's really a balance. Because you, on the one hand, I totally agree with you. And I myself engage in
absolutely
not saying everything that's on my mind in every unfiltered way.
Which took a while to learn, right?
Sure. It's a craft, and
but how to do it with integrity is what I hear you saying.
Right, that's exactly right, and not
out of fear,
and therefore toe the line on something that you don't want to toe the line on.
And by the way, we'll all pay the price for
right
because don't think that what you're creating is a better world that way.
You're certainly not, and you're letting the other people who have much less concern for either integrity or truth or whatever it is. Or you know what? Give them credit. It's their opinion,
right?
But like, you better say, you know, say to people like, you know, no, we want to, at least in my world, I'm saying like, I want to hold on to this land. I'm not going to count. And by the way, I'm not going to blame the Arabs for being bad for the reason why I'm holding on to this land. That's one of my most hated.
If we let it go, then they'll just, you know, it'll be just like Gaza, right?
Even more, like, we would give them the land. But they've rejected it.
Right.
And therefore, it's their fault.
Right.
And I can show you how many times I've offered you land.
I've tried to give my land away.
Which makes you dumb twice.
Yeah.
You're so dumb that you want to give away your land. And you're so dumb that you can't even manage to give away your land to the Arabs. You can't even figure out how to give it away. That's how stupid you are. And everybody's laughing at you. I'm like, that is that whole line just makes you look so foolish.
Yeah.
And that's a mistake. Okay, the Torah portion ends with a list of the holidays, the sacrifices involved in the holidays, and the whole cyclical part of life that you're going to live with entering into the land of Israel, and basically a wink to the temple.
Yes.
To temple life and to the three and a quarter pilgrimage holidays. I'm adding, of course, Shmini Atzeret as this quasi
separate. It is its own chag.
It's his own chag, but it's not
a separate pilgrimage because you're already there.
Right. You're already there, but it's its own chag. Maybe a very special chag in some ways. The
very deep
denouma.
Yeah,
the 3+1. It's the 3+1. Yeah. Oh, we talked about denouma. You weren't here. We talked about the three prophecies plus one of Bilam.
With Bilam.
So here it is again, and we learned
definitely a pattern.
Denouma. Benuman. Okay, so we try to. I'm sure Eric is going to write to me. Also, by the way, I do want to say hi to a new listener, a good friend, Ori, who was here in the land of Israel recently. Went on great deal with him, and he listens on his drive in California. So I want to say hi to him, and I want to say hi to all the folks out there. You guys are, if you're listening this far, that means that you're really committed to.
Dedicated.
You're dedicated. For sure. And so, how about a hashtag dedicated? How about hashtag dedicated?
Speaking of dedication, you can also dedicate shows.
That's right. In fact, I have two dedications coming up, so I'm very excited about that.
Excellent.
I'm very excited about the dedications that are coming up. So parshas with dedications are coming up, and that's at your website, jewishstory.co. Yeah,
that's right. And if you want to dedicate, you can send me an email, Rav Mike at the Land of Israel, or you can find me on Facebook, Rav Mike Foyer. Facebook.
Very good. And myself, Yishai Fleischer, just Yishai at thelandofisrael.com, Yishai at yishaifleischer.com, if whatever helps you remember. I also want to thank, and the website, yishaifleischer.com, all thelandofisrael.com, that's where all of our great shows are. Very proud to be part of this network. And lastly, I want to thank my good friends, Moshe Herman, Ben Bresky, Tabitha, for making this show happen. I want to thank you for making the show happen just by listening and by helping spread the ideas of the land of Israel, of Torah, of God's real great vision. Malka Fleischer is off this week, and that means it's the end of the show. I want to thank you so much, Rabbi Mike. Great to see you again.
Always a pleasure.
And may we serve God in some of the great thoughts that we had on this week's show.
Amen, amen.
Lots of love, and last final piece of advice, don't let the Twitter sphere and the media sphere and all that get you down. It's an amazing, amazing, and beautiful time that we're living in.
Unplug and tune in, people.
Yeah, unplug and tune in. Is that a 60s thing?
It's similar.
Yeah,
it's a paraphrase.
Drop in, drop out or something.
Right, yeah. It's a
unplug and tune in. That's exactly right. Unplug from the silliness because there's a lot of noise out there.
Yes.
There's a lot of noise out there, and its purpose is to be noise, to somehow sully the incredible revelation that's happening.
At the risk of adding content to the end, you know, Yuval Harari points out that...
Who is that?
Yuval Harari. He's an important historian. He's written like Sapiens.
Okay. Right. Holy,
He says that it used to be that censorship happened through the control, the limiting of information, but in our world that's impossible. Now it happens through distraction.
Mm.
Right?
And, MS.
And that's a lot of what you're describing.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. I like when I,
so
I
keep focused.
When I follow a lot of like Twitter bad folks, I, like my day starts off with this just ton of full of, and they've generated tons of junk.
Yeah.
Usually high quality junk.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's out there. Don't let yourself fall into that. Don't believe in the hype. You know, turn it all off and just look up to God and say, thank you for living in this incredible time. All right, Rabbi Mike, thanks so much for joining us. God bless you. Shabbat shalom. Lots of love.
Shabbat shalom.
Shalom from Yerushalayim, the land of blessings. Shalom.
No nation on earth more mirrors the United States in its origin and in its experience as Israel does.
This week on Rejuvenation with Eve Harrow, an exclusive interview with former Governor Mike Huckabee, who visited Israel, including the headquarters of the Land of Israel Network.
Israel is a country that, like the origins of the United States, was created by people who came here to escape tyranny. And one reason that every American should be adamant that Israel have its land is because the Holocaust would never have happened had there been a Jewish homeland.
Check out this exclusive interview on Rejuvenation with Eve Harrow on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.